I call the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee meeting to order on March 12, 2024. Members, today is Poultry Day, so I want to recognize a couple of folks in the room. First one is a student, Riley Joyer from FFA, from Turkey Growers. If you can wave your hand. Thank you for being here. Pleasure to have you join us today. And then we also have two testifiers to do a presentation for us in relation to Poultry Day. So we have Ashley Coles, Executive Director from Minnesota Turkey Growers Association, Kevin Stiles, Executive Director from North Central Poultry Association. If you can make your way and identify yourself for the record and proceed. Thank you for being here.
Good afternoon. Chair Bang, members of the committee, my name is Ashley Coles, and I serve the turkey industry as the executive director for the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association. As Chair Bang mentioned, today is Poultry Day at the Capitol. For those who may not know, Minnesota's turkey industry is robust in the state of Minnesota. Minnesota is and continues to be the number one turkey producing state in the nation. To put some numbers to that, they contribute over $12 billion to the state's economic activity annually and create 46,000 jobs across the state. Every sector of the turkey industry, from hatchery to retail, is represented in the state of Minnesota, and actually every sector of the industry from hatcheries to retail is represented here today amongst our members. So when you think of turkey, many folks tend to think of the holiday season, where turkey is commonly featured at many family celebrations. When our members think of turkey, they think of the 600 turkey farmers across the state that work daily to produce high-quality turkey that many Americans feed to their families outside of the holiday season daily and year-round. But personally, and it wouldn't be a service to our industry if I didn't say here, when I personally reflect on the turkey industry, I think of the resiliency of the turkey industry with the continuous challenge of high path avian influenza that continues to plague our industry. Since we were here last year, there's been over 300 turkey farmers impacted by high path just since last year when we came here. We are not a single issue organization. You will hear a lot of us talk about high path avian influenza, but it is the primary concern that our industry has and continues to face. So there's turkey growers on both sides of the room today. We've had meetings with many of you and have meetings scheduled with many of you through the balance of the day. If you've not had a chance to meet with a grower today and would like to, let us know and they'd be happy to talk about you know, what they do, why they do it, and how they do raising high-quality turkey.
Good afternoon. I'm Kevin Stiles with North Central Poultry Association. Thanks for having us here today. We appreciate it, and of course, appreciate the partnership we have with the turkey folks here in the state of Minnesota. It really is a cohesive industry. We work together on so many issues, and a lot of the topics that we're talking today with legislators are shared issues, whether it be high-path avian influenza related, whether it be workforce and rural Minnesota issues. All those topics are important to both of our industries. With us today, we also have representatives of egg producers, our emerging leaders, and they are here and would also enjoy visiting with you. And we also would encourage you, if you have the opportunity, to get out and visit our farms and see firsthand our industry and the importance that we play in the state of Minnesota. We, of course, also in the state of Minnesota, we have approximately 7 million laying hens, just for your information, so producing about 2.5 billion eggs every year. And of course, there's times of the year that all of our industries are center of the spotlight, so to speak, but we're approaching Easter. And of course, to some degree, we approach that as our Super Bowl, so to speak. So we're looking forward to you all enjoying celebrating Easter with us and enjoying your eggs, whether it be egg hunts or at your breakfast table. So thank you for having us today.
Thank you. Any quick questions from members of the committee? Representative Anderson?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just couldn't forget the Super Bowl of Easter. Hey, I like wings, and that's the Super Bowl of Super Bowls, so thank you for the great food of chicken wings as well.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted also to
highlight that some of us got to attend the turkey pardoning at the White House this most recent Thanksgiving, which was in 2023. I think this was the first time we had Minnesota-grown birds at that ceremony for several decades. So that was a pretty big deal, and we were very fortunate to be invited, and thank you to the turkey producers, the families who got to attend, who actually grew the birds, and it was nice to get that shout out because we talk a lot about the high path avian influenza. It was nice to get some positive press, so just wanted to note that, and thank your organization for your great work.
Yeah, agreed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for being here today. Pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
All right, members, we'll jump us. There is a quorum present, so we will do approval of the minutes. Vice Chair Purcell may have a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Purcell moves to approve the minutes for March 7th, 2024. Any discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 7, 2024 are approved. So our first bill for today is Representative Berg, House File 4659. If you can make your way to the table. And I move that House File 4659 be re-referred to the Climate and Energy Committee. Welcome, Representative Berg, if you can introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As you know, the state of Minnesota is making significant investments to fund broadband deployment, and we are about to receive a substantial one-time fusion from the federal government to help assure all Minnesota homes and businesses have access to high-speed broadband in all corners of the state. And so it is critically important that we get this right. We need to ensure not only that we are investing in high-quality, reliable broadband infrastructure, but that the work is done safely and in a manner that develops the skilled workforce that will continue building, maintaining, upgrading, and replacing broadband infrastructure for decades to come. House File 4659 establishes guardrails to ensure that broadband is not being deployed at the expense of public safety or in ways that compromise critical electric, gas, water, and telecommunications infrastructure. This bill raises quality and safety standards, enhances training, reduces turnover, and ensures that broadband investments deliver middle-class jobs. It also leverages state and federal investments to support development of skilled workforce and creation of family-supporting careers for Minnesotans. The bill does this by awarding a portion of state and federal broadband development grants for applicants who promote workforce development best practices, including provision of skills training and family-supported wages and benefits. Applicants can demonstrate this either by 1, paying prevailing wage rates, which are already required for deployment of middle-mile broadband, or 2, by providing employer-funded training, family health coverage, and retirement benefits. This bill would not prevent an applicant from seeking funding, regardless of whether the applicant implements workforce best practices, as long as the applicant complies with federal law. This bill also establishes a basic safety training standard for the installation of broadband, similar to what exists today for pipe laying, and also holds providers accountable if their installers damage critical underground infrastructure when broadband is installed. And with that, Madam Chair, I have a testifier to speak further to the bill, as well as subject matter experts in the room available to answer any questions.
Okay. Before that, we do have an A1 amendment, and I believe this is into the shape that you want it. So I move that the A1 amendment to be adopted. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The ayes have it. The A1 is adopted. So to the bill as amended, I believe Adam Hutchins. If you can identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Vang and committee members. For the record, my name is Adam Hutchins. I'm an organizer and researcher for LIUNA. I've spent the last 18 years working in the construction industry as a laborer, a superintendent, a project manager, and eventually transitioning to a training instructor for our apprenticeship program. I also serve on the governor's broadband task force. I lead a team that's visited active job sites all over the state and interviewed broadband installers and industry professionals, observing the deployment work of both grant recipients and telecoms that do not receive federal subsidies. I personally conducted numerous worker interviews at job sites, and during these interviews, we've never seen a workforce reporting such low levels of training, high job dissatisfaction, and concern for the safety and the high rates of turnover in the industry. As someone who has performed highly sensitive safety work and taught safety courses, I was not expecting to find this kind of unsafe work practices that we found investigating the broadband installation. Installers reported receiving little to no training, including those responsible for safety-sensitive positions such as exposing existing utilities and tracking the location of the directional drill borehead in relation to crossing existing underground infrastructure. Many also clearly lacked the on-the-job experience due to the extraordinary high turnover rates. When asked about the conditions that contributed to the turnover, many cited low wages, lack of benefits, and high stress. In many instances, broadband crews are drilling around and crossing existing utilities without exposing them as required by law. Unsurprisingly, we learned that broadband installers are regularly damaging underground electric, gas, water, and telecommunication lines, often resulting in the loss of service. Some of these incidents have potential of resulting in major injury or worse to workers and the community residents. House File 4659 will establish basic safety training that will help prevent line strikes and increase worker safety. It will encourage broadband providers seeking public funding to commit to better workforce practices that will help stabilize and upskill the Minnesota broadband installation workforce for years to come. It will also hold providers accountable if their installers continue to damage critical underground infrastructure when broadband is installed. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I strongly urge you to support House File 4659.
Thank you, Adam. Our next testifier is John Boucher, Director of Government and Public Affairs from Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota. If you can identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Beshe. I'm here on behalf of the Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some brief comments on House File 4659. ABC is a trade association that's made up of 340 commercial and industrial contractors and their 20,000 plus employees. These men and women are part of the 75% of workers in Minnesota's construction industry that choose to be merit shop craft professionals. ABC promotes free enterprise and fair and open competition in the construction industry in which anyone can succeed based on merit. We oppose violence, coercion, intimidation, and the denial of rights of both employees and management, and we believe that work opportunities should be made available to all people regardless of labor affiliation. First and foremost, I just want to say ABC and our members take safety incredibly seriously. Many of our members have partnerships with Minnesota OSHA and provide in-house safety training. Our concerns with this bill center on some of the requirements for determining whether somebody meets the workforce practices that are detailed in the bill. First, we are concerned with the subjectiveness of the requirement that there be credible evidence of support from one or more labor management, or other workforce organizations. We think the goal there is laudable, but we are concerned that this requirement could be used to favor certain segments of the industry over others. For example, ABC is a trade association. Will credible evidence of support from a trade association like ours be considered sufficient when considering whether an applicant meets those requirements? Is there going to be specific criteria that will be used to specify whether the recommending entity has a sufficient track record? In short, we are concerned that in practice, anything less than union or labor support will be considered insufficient for this requirement. Second, it's not quite clear to us why a contractor would be able to opt to either pay prevailing wage or provide the 80 hours of skills training annually, the benefits, and the retirement payments. If this bill is about safety and quality of training, the fact that a contractor could opt to pay prevailing wage rather than provide the 80 hours annual skills training as the amendment dictates just doesn't make sense. The payment of prevailing wage is not synonymous with quality or safety, nor does it guarantee that an employee is going to receive those benefits. In conclusion, as written, we respectfully request a no vote on the bill, but I thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Director John. Next, we have Ms. Grant Christensen, President of Minnesota Telecom Alliance. If you can identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I'm the President and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. MTA membership is a mix of cooperatives, family-owned, privately held, and publicly traded broadband providers throughout Minnesota. And while MTA members have many different corporate structures, one thing we have in common is our commitment to serving Minnesota. This year, my members are planning on investing nearly $300 million in private capital to expand broadband in Minnesota. And I will also add that MTA operates a safety program where we do telecom-specific safety training in Minnesota, Iowa, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Ohio. So I take exception to the previous testifiers' comments about our safety program, safety training for broadband providers. I'm here today to oppose House File 4659. My members oppose this bill for a variety of technical and policy reasons, but most importantly, because it does not comply with the notice for funding opportunity issued by the National Telecommunications and Information Agency, or NTIA, for the BEAD program. It also does not conform with Volume 2 of the plan filed by the Office of Broadband Development last December. This legislation puts at risk the loss of nearly $652 million in federal BEAD dollars earmarked for Minnesota in two ways. First, it does not comply with the BEAD program and rules and obligations. And second, I've heard from my members that they have no intention applying for BEAD dollars under these conditions. The reporting obligations and regulatory burdens are too onerous and not worth the matching private investment. So what happens when the private providers walk away and don't participate? Well, I can tell you, it won't get built. And if it doesn't get built, then the state of Minnesota will default on its obligation to NTIA. Madam Chair and members, this legislature established a process long ago to address broadband deployment challenges. For more than 15 years, the Governor's Broadband Task Force has worked to address issues related to broadband deployment. Each year, the task force is required to file a report with recommendations to the governor and legislature. This has worked well for 15 years, and this bill does an end run around the very process that this body put in place. Proponents of this bill know this, and their representatives even serve on the task force. For the integrity of the process and for the work of the all-volunteer process, or all-volunteer task force, this matter should be sent back to the task force for study. Otherwise, what's the point in having the task force? With that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, President Brent. Our next testifier is Tony Mendoza from Minnesota Cable. If you can identify yourself before the committee and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Tony Mendoza. I'm counsel to the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. MCCA is concerned about the impact HF 4659 will have on achieving universal broadband for Minnesota. The state and the Biden administration set aggressive goals for universal broadband and dedicated millions toward achieving those goals. The Biden administration is allocating $652 million to Minnesota through the BEAD program administered by the NTIA. In designing BEAD, NTIA mandated that the Office of Broadband Development award grants, quote, in a manner that ensures the deployment of service to all unserved locations. NTIA provided OBD 4 years to deploy $652 million to meet that mandate. The Minnesota legislature set a goal that by 2026, all Minnesota businesses and homes have access to broadband at 100 over 20 megabits per second. This year, OBD celebrates its 10th anniversary. Over those 10 years, MCCA members have worked in strong partnership with OBD to create what's nationally known as the Minnesota model. Through that model, we've brought our state to the threshold of universal broadband. BEAD funding provides a once-in-a-generation opportunity to cross that threshold. OBD has already submitted its BEAD plan, which currently is under review by the NTIA. Recognizing the need for speed and to stretch BEAD funding as far as it can go to achieve the federal universal broadband mandate, Congress didn't apply the Davis-Bacon Act to BEAD. for the same reasons the Minnesota legislature hasn't required prevailing wages on state-funded last-mile broadband projects. This bill puts OBD in a catch-22. If prevailing wages are required, the state will fail to meet the federal mandate and the state's 2026 goal. Whether you support the policies in the bill or not is beside the point. It's simply a question of math. Because MCCA believes it's important for Minnesota to meet the BEAD mandate and the state broadband goal, MCCA opposes the bill. If the committee prioritizes prevailing wages and the labor standards in this bill over achieving universal broadband goals, this bill moves forward, MCCA has questions about the bill included in a letter that we will be providing to the committee. We will work with stakeholders and the author on those issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Our next testifier is Brian Cook from Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. If you can identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Vang and members of the Agricultural Finance and Policy Committee, my name is Brian Cook. I'm the Director of Energy and Elections Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Appreciate the opportunity to share some of our concerns with Representative Berg's House File 4659. The Minnesota Chamber, which represents over 6,300 businesses with over 500,000 employees, recognizes that a vibrant local and globally competitive economy depends on digital connectivity. Minnesota businesses and workers require a robust, modern, secure, and accessible broadband network throughout the state. Minnesota's telecommunications providers have invested billions of dollars to build out infrastructure while increasing access, speed, and availability for customers. In addition, public investment in broadband expansion has received hundreds of millions of dollars in recent years, with significant additional funding already guaranteed over the next decade. Yet places in Minnesota still lack a reliable, fast internet connection. These places tend to be where geography, population density, or other issues make the business case for deployment economically challenging. That's why the provisions of House File 4659 are so troubling to us. The proposed mandates on companies participating in the border-to-border broadband grant program and the broadband equity access and deployment program will increase the cost and complexity of deploying state and federal funds to reach our connectivity goals. We oppose the state leveraging grant programs that depend on successful public-private partnerships to dictate terms of employment for those businesses. We already have a daunting challenge to deploy the federal funds coming to Minnesota through the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act by the end of this decade. Our state has an opportunity to make a major step towards reaching our connectivity goals to the benefit of Minnesota employers and employees. But mandates like those contained in House File 4659 will only jeopardize our ability to succeed. Thank you for the opportunity to share our concerns with you today.
All right. Thank you, Brian. Our final testifier is Justin Jans, CEO from East Central Energy. If you can identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Justin Johns. I'm the president and CEO of East Central Energy. We are a not-for-profit, member-owned electric cooperative, and we're building a fiber network to the nearly 100,000 Minnesotans that we provide electricity to today. I'm here to share our concerns regarding the proposed legislation on fair labor standards, particularly in relation to its impact on some of the poorest Minnesotans in the state. I would like to add that we've had some good dialogue with labor, some conversations about what compromise could look like, and so we look forward to continued conversation. Now, our organization is deeply invested in bridging the digital divide in rural areas, striving to provide high-speed internet access to every family in our service territory. However, the economic landscape of our project is already delicate. We serve many economically disadvantaged and socially vulnerable families, and the final cost of internet service is a critical component of our project. We want to see every child growing up in rural Minnesota have access to high-speed internet so they have the same digital opportunities as kids growing up in the metro areas. I want to emphasize the invaluable support that we have received from the State Office of Minnesota, particularly from the Office of Broadband Development and from the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Their guidance and funding mechanisms have set a national standard for efficient and effective broadband development initiatives. Bree Mackey and the OBD staff have been instrumental in our project's success thus far. This proposed legislation threatens to undermine projects like ours by adding further financial strain to projects already burdened by permitting costs, supply chain issues, the make-ready of poles, and rising fiber costs. This bill would jeopardize our ability to fulfill our commitment to providing broadband access to struggling rural communities. In our opinion, the legislature should trust in Bree's proven track record and allow the Office of Broadband Development to continue their commendable work without the constraints that reduce the feasibility of already difficult projects. They know the recipe for success. Let's let them continue to execute on it. Thank you to the committee for the opportunity to share a bit of our story and for your consideration.
Thank you, CEO Justin. I don't see any further testifiers, so we will move to discussion to the bill. Questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking through the bill in the amendment, and I don't see a date where this bill would go into effect. Could staff help me find that date?
Mr. Sullivan?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I also don't believe there's a date specified in the bill, and when that's the case, the Minnesota statute section 645.02 provides that the bill, unless it has an appropriation, would take effect the following August 1st. So I assume this bill, unless specified otherwise, would take effect this August 1st.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Sullivan. Well, on page 2 of the bill, line 16, it calls for 50% of all of these projects to be implemented or affected by this bill in the year 2024, which is the year we are currently in. So to the bill authors, your understanding that we would be able to meet those goals yet this year with this bill taking effect in 2024?
Representative Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Anderson. I am going to have one of our subject matter experts come to the stand.
If you can identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Vang. Thank you, committee member. For the 2024 goal, if the implementation timeline could not match up with the next round, it could be adjusted to make sure that next round is taken into consideration. So it would be available to be amended to make that work. We're committed to making that work.
Representative Anderson.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair. So what we're hearing is that this bill needs a little bit more work. And I would ask the question, I've been around here for a while, and we've been told that for years Minnesota has a standard, the gold standard in the nation for broadband deployment. Our Office of Broadband Development does an excellent job getting out state grants, being matched by private capital. And just wondering if the Broadband Development Office had input into this. Do they see a need for this type of bill? And if the bill author or somebody could answer that question, I would appreciate that.
Yeah. Representative Anderson, so today is the 10-year anniversary of the Office of Broadband, and unfortunately they weren't able to attend today's committee, but it was not intentional that I schedule in conflict of their event, this bill is going through a couple committees, and so there will be opportunities for the Office of Broadband to provide input to us well, and I will remain in close contact with the Office of Broadband regarding this bill too. And Representative Burr, if you'd like to respond to Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Responding broadly, we're very open to suggestions and to continued work on this bill. Ultimately, we just want equitable access to broadband for all Minnesota families, and we think that we can do that while also creating good middle-class jobs. So thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Just a final comment, Madam Chair. I would agree that our goal is for deployment statewide for all of our residents. But just from hearing some of the testifiers today, it would appear that increasing safety standards, prevailing wages, things like that, it's going to slow down this project and result in fewer homes being reached and possibly not meeting our goal by the year 2026. So I would encourage continued work on this bill, but in its current form, I just can't support it. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I will, too, raise some of the same concerns. You know, I've part of the district that I represent, or most of the district I represent, 11B, Pine County and Kanabec County make up the largest portion of that district. And those counties are ranked 85th and 87th. Maybe the Justin Johns can nod his head if I'm correct on that. But there, you know, we're in the poorest coverage of the entire state, and you know, East Central Energy, as well as some other, you know, entities, are doing some great work on providing service in our area, expanding that, and you know, it's there's a wait list right now of people anticipating getting broadband service to their home, and I know in their monthly newsletter, I don't think they want to say we're delaying this, and you know, there's a lot of private capital as well in going into this, and I think I think the intentions of the bill may be good, of making sure there's safety standards. I think we've got a good safety network right now. You know, is there any, what are the on the records, or you know, how many incidents are there of, you know, whether it's pipelines, or you know, how often is this happening that there's you know, issues and problems with installations?
Representative Berg or Adam?
Thank you, Chair Vang. Thank you for your question. Right now, line strikes are in over the hundreds in the state of Minnesota every year. So it's a pretty frequent, almost daily activity.
Representative Nelson?
Okay. Thank you, Chair Vang. Do we have any data that shows, you know, where is it to other states? Is that, I mean, not that we want to be an outlier. I mean, we'd love to be a leader, but in the correct area of leading. Where does that, how do other states fare, or do you not know?
Adam?
Thank you, Chair Vang. Thank you, committee member. So in relation to other states, it's hard to gauge because the Office of Pipeline Safety, MnOps, in the state of Minnesota tracks all the strikes of underground gas and electric. They don't have there's no state statute to require the line strike data to be provided to them. So there's not a bulletproof answer. Every state has different reporting requirements. So to compare apples to apples is almost impossible under current situations. But it is frequent in the state of Minnesota, to say the least.
Representative Nelson?
I think, thank you for that. And, you know, yes, safety is something that we want to have. We do want to make sure we have, you know, good wages, but at the same time, I think, you know, we've got to weigh this all out, too, of, you know, you know, are we an outlier? I don't know if we've gotten that answer. And I think, you know, we've got a good system with the Office of Broadband, and, you know, I think this is a bill looking for a problem and not the other way around. So I would encourage not supporting it.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Chair Vang. We're a little luckier in northwest Minnesota. We've got some good providers up there, but we still have our deserts as well, Marshall County in particular. Not nearly as bad as Pine County in Representative Nelson's district, but still concerning that this is going to slow things down. And I would like to ask the author in particular on Section 1, I think it's page, it should be 3.8, but if the deed office of broadband does not receive enough applicants, that section, to achieve the standards, rather than accept applicants who don't meet the standards, the bill directs them to, and it's quoted in here, to consult with prospective applicants and labor workforce organizations to solicit additional qualified applicants. And my concern is that in rural areas in particular, I don't know how that's going to work, but given the way our winters are in Minnesota, the risk of losing a construction season, I just worried we're going to throw the sand in the gears on this. So could you explain to me what that would mean? How would they solicit additional qualified applicants if there's only so many to solicit from?
Representative Berg or Adam?
Thank you, Chair Vang. Thank you for the question. So that is the intent of having the three parameters. You can either use prevailing wage, use best practices, or there's also a sliver of 50% in the first year, 40, and then steps down to 30. Okay. If you could meet none of those provisions, you could still apply for grant funding. So the money and the grant funding will essentially be untouched by those rules in specific situations like you're referencing.
Representative Burkle.
Okay, I understand that, but is it true then that those would be put to the back end of the list if they don't meet those parameters?
Adam.
Thank you, Chair Vang. Yeah, the incentive is to find contractors and providers using best practices, and there are providers currently that are receiving grant funding that are using best practices today and will be ready day one of this to roll out. So,
Representative Burkle.
Yeah, I understand that. But like I said, in the case in rural Minnesota in particular, it's concerning to me. Another question for the author here quick. So the governor's task force on broadband, I mean, there's a purpose for that. Why would we bypass? I heard from one of the testifiers that that was the case, that there was no consultation between the folks writing this bill and the task force. Is there a reason for that? Why wouldn't we bring them into the loop?
Representative Berg or Adam?
Thank you, Chair Vang. Thank you for the question. So I was put on the task force at the end of last year. We've only had two meetings, and with the BEAD funding coming so soon and Volume 2 not being approved for the BEAD funding in the state of Minnesota, we have a huge opportunity right now to set the standards going forward. And if we don't meet that, if we don't put a little stability in the market of what's going to be expected out of the BEAD funding, we won't have a chance to make sure that these jobs are made and quality, and we build out infrastructure with quality jobs in the time to come. So,
Representative Burkle.
I'll close things up here. Well, I'd argue that we already have that stable funding now. I'm concerned this is going to make things more difficult, especially in our rural areas. But the comment was made that, you know, there's a business case to be made. I think Mr. Rice made that comment. Business case for broadband deployment. This will make it economically challenging. And I'm concerned that's where we're going here. And I'd be a no vote on this bill. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a personal story about what happened in our city of Chanhassen. We had an internet provider laying down line, and they ended up cutting a wire that powered the streetlights along a frontage road in front of the Chanhassen American Legion. And a lot of people were asking, you know, why are their streetlights not working? Well, it was because they had punctured or they had cut a wire, and that was done in the fall. So we weren't able to repair that until the ground thawed the following spring. And I shudder to think of what would have happened if they would have cut, say, a gas line or something a lot more dangerous. So I know in the suburbs, you know, we're having issues too with some of these workers maybe not being trained well enough to know where the lines are. And so I think an emphasis on safety is really important. And I appreciate Representative Berg bringing this bill forward.
Further discussion? Closing remarks, Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the robust discussion. I think that we oftentimes get caught in this paradigm of if we're putting emphasis on safety and using best practices, if we are employing skilled labor, which are usually union jobs that create a family-sustaining wage and benefits for the workers, then somehow all of those components together are going to slow down the work and or make it so the work isn't as quality as it should be. And I would say that the opposite is true. If we are paying our highly skilled workers, if we are employing the highest safety standards, if we are using the best possible fibers, we are going to get equitable, strong, and reliable access to broadband across the state. So I'm happy to have more conversations offline, open to ideas and improvements, and I hope you'll support this bill. Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Anderson.
I'd like to ask for a roll call, Madam Chair.
Okay, a roll call being requested, and seeing no further discussion, we will move to roll call. I believe this is on the renewing my motion for House Files 4659 as amended be referred to the Climate and Energy Committee. The clerk would take the roll.
Chair Vang.
Aye.
Vice Chair Purcell.
Aye.
Lead Anderson.
Anderson, no.
Representative Burkle?
Burkle, no.
Representative Cha?
Aye.
Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Representative Harder?
No.
Representative Jacob?
No.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Ream?
Aye.
Representative Sensenmura?
Aye.
Representative Tabke?
Aye.
There being 8 ayes and 5 noes, the motion prevails. House File 4659 as amended is re-referred to the Climate and Energy Committee. All right, next bill we have is House File 3410, Representative Freiberg. And welcome to the committee, Representative Freiberg. I will move that House File 3410 be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. And with that, please, to the bill, Representative Freiberg. Oh, I believe we also have the A1 amendment to as well. Is that the amendment that you'd like to put in the shape that you like it in, Representative Freiberg?
Yes, please.
All right. So with the A1 amendment to be adopted, all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The ayes have it, and the A1 is adopted. So to the bill as amended, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Chair Vang and members of the committee. This is a bipartisan bill that was brought to me by the Animal Humane Society, which is Minnesota's largest nonprofit companion and animal welfare organization. AHS operates 3 shelters in the Twin Cities area, including one in the district I represent. And I know that many people in this room, including me, have likely adopted pets from one of these shelters. We've shared the language of this bill with numerous stakeholders, including the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association, which is neutral on the bill. This bill is simply about transparency. In Minnesota, kennels, shelters like the Animal Humane Society, and state-licensed commercial breeders are required to be licensed and inspected. Under current law, the inspection reports and other data for commercial breeders are classified as private under the Data Practices Act, so consumers cannot see the inspection reports even if they plan to purchase pets from a breeder. The same reports for kennels and shelters are already public data. People want access to information they can trust, whether they are choosing a restaurant, a hairstylist, or a dog and cat breeder. There's a chart in your packet showing that inspection data for most state licensing boards in Minnesota is already public, and most boards post the information online. My bill treats dog and cat breeders like other regulated businesses. With that, I can turn it over to my testifiers. I believe Kim LeBeau from the Animal Humane Society is here to speak on it as well.
Okay. Kim, if you can identify yourself before the record and proceed.
Chair Vang and committee members, thank you for hearing this bill today. I am Kim LeBeau with Animal Humane Society. And each year, Animal Humane Society adopts more than 12,000 pets at our 3 metro area shelters. And as an animal shelter, we are licensed and inspected by the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. And by law, licensing and inspection data for Animal Humane Society in all of Minnesota's nonprofit animal shelters and other regulated businesses is public data. In contrast, this same information on state-licensed dog and cat breeders has been classified as private data. So as a result, I can find out more about my state-licensed hair salon than I can about the breeder who raised my puppy. This bill makes breeder data public and holds commercial breeders to the same transparency standards as nonprofit shelters, dog and cat dealers, and other regulated businesses. This applies to about 107 state-licensed commercial dog and cat breeders defined by law as breeders with 10 or more adults that produce over 5 litters a year. This doesn't apply to small breeders who are not required to be state-licensed. And while Animal Humane Society encourages people to adopt, we also support responsible breeders. And this position has been stated on our website for the past 13 years. As part of our position statement, we encourage people to do their research before they spend thousands of dollars on a new pet. This bill will allow people to do their homework so they know if a puppy was raised with 5 or 500 dogs, if they're a repeat violator, or if their license was revoked. So we encourage you to pass this bill because it ensures consumers have access to critical information before they make a significant financial and emotional investment in a new pet. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim. Our next testifier is Andrew Willman from Rough Start Rescue. Is he here today?
Yes. Can you hear me? Sorry.
All right. Yes, we can hear you. If you can identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Absolutely. Chair Vang and committee members, Thank you for providing the opportunity to provide testimony remotely. I'm Andrew Willman, Board Secretary of Rough Start Rescue, and our organization strongly supports this bill. A little bit of background about Rough Start Rescue. We are a foster-based companion animal rescue located in Princeton, Minnesota. Our facility in Princeton provides space for veterinary care and temporary emergency housing for animals in our care. We also have a statewide network of people who foster primarily dogs and cats along with the occasional critter in their homes. Like commercial dog and cat breeders, Rough Start Rescue is licensed and inspected by the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. We do not think it is right that nonprofits are held to higher transparency standards than for-profit breeders. A little bit of supplementary notes here, bullets, as to why this bill is needed. Our organization tells people who want to purchase a purebred dog from a breeder to do their homework, simple as that. Dogs from commercial breeders sometimes end up in our care. Many times, or sometimes, the dogs are well cared for, some are not, and suffered both physical and emotional effects from neglect, and we're looking to provide transparency into this abuse. It's difficult for people to know which breeder to choose from because there isn't a reliable source of information. There are over 100 state-licensed commercial dog and cat breeders in Minnesota, and yet consumers are denied access to valuable information collected by the state, such as the names of the breeders with revoked licenses. Therefore, we strongly support more transparency of the commercial breeding industry in Minnesota and think that this bill is a good start.
Thank you, Andrew. Our final testifier is Darren Macbeth from Minnesota Pet Breeders Association. If you can identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Darren Macbeth, representing the Minnesota Pet Breeders Association. Yes, an association exists representing those who breed pets. We have among the Minnesota Pet Breeders Association businesses, they are businesses, they do it for profit to breed purebred and special traits and attributes in dogs mostly that people desire for showing purposes, for hunting purposes, for a companion animal in their home, that they want to pick out the type of dog and in the pedigree that suits them. And what needs to be brought to your attention and on the record here is the apples and oranges metaphor, the apples and oranges difference between animal rescues and shelters, known as kennels in the law, and breeders, or commercial breeders, which I'll talk about in a second. And the apples and oranges difference is where the dogs and pets or cats come from to shelters and rescues. Sometimes it's not known. Sometimes the animals, yes, they're neglected or unwanted. They're stray. Many shelters acquire by the hundreds animals from other states that have been different for different reasons and different impacts to those animals versus purpose-bred and raised pets from a breeder. In 2014, the law that we have now, the commercial breeder law, was negotiated, and yes, the data privacy or the business operating data of breeders, if they met the definition of a commercial breeder, was protected and declared private, non-public. And as you heard, the definition of a commercial breeder, who are required to have a license, meet standards of care, undergo inspections, all governed by the Board of Animal Health, and the data they get from those things are of 10 intact animals and at least 5 litters per year. And so the last thing I want to say in summary is you've heard of the request for transparency and more information and be a level playing field, but A, when there's apples and oranges, different kinds of businesses, and B, it's not really the customer who is wanting this information, as you've heard today, because customers can ask the breeder. And if they hear an answer they don't like or they disagree with of that breeder's situation, they don't have to buy the animal and they can go somewhere else. It's really activist organizations and people who don't like the concept of breeders versus rescues who want this information to.
Thank you, Darren.
I'm not sure what they want to do with it. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any further testifiers, so we'll move to discussion of the bill. Questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I love dogs. I love yellow labs and the greatest animals there are. But, you know, I've been around back in 2014, too, where we worked this compromise out where the breeders were licensed and regulated. And the Board of Animal Health contains a list of those in good standing. And the Board of Animal Health must share that information. And so I guess I just kind of go back to that 2014 compromise where this information of breeders was to negotiate it to be kept private. And I would stand by that compromise, Madam Chair.
Representative Jacob.
Well, thank you, Chair Vang. So in Winona County, we've got more dog kennels than any other county in the state of Minnesota. With that, the majority of those dog kennels are operated by the Amish community. And out of respect for their religious beliefs, they try to be as private as they possibly can. So do you have any concerns about, first of all, privacy, and then I'll have a follow-up question about biosecurity?
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. I think some of the, you know, there was a letter I noticed in your packets from the American Kennel Club, and it talked about the potential to visit private homes and making people's private homes, information about people's private homes public. The amendment that we adopted at the beginning actually gets rid of that requirement and I think addresses some of those concerns about privacy. It says only that the city or township where the breeder is located has to be made public. So I think, especially with the adoption of the amendment, I believe the privacy concerns are addressed.
Representative Jacob.
Well, once you have the person's name and their county, it's as simple as going on Beacon to find where their address is. So it's the same difference as giving out their private information. And with that, these facilities are just top-notch facilities. The kennels are nicer than many of the homes that I've been in, and they are just so concerned about anything being brought into those facilities. So if someone comes to the premises, they're going to have to put on essentially a, you know, not a hazmat suit, but a white suit and footwear and headgear. This all makes those places more accessible. And do you have any concerns about people potentially coming to these facilities and bringing diseases to these dogs that weren't there previously?
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Jacob. I guess not really. The bill doesn't change anything related to access to these provisions. It only says that data that's not identified by, you know, by address has to be made public. And so that's like the number of animals that they're keeping, any record of violations. It sounds like you're describing a really strong organization there. So I imagine they would have nothing to be concerned about.
Representative Jacob.
That's fine. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, closing remarks, Representative Freiberg?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate you hearing this bill. Like I said, it's an important data transparency bill. I think it will give potential customers and people who want to adopt animals access to information that's not previously available. So thank you again.
Right. I renew my motion for House File 4659 as amended. Be we refer to the Climate and Energy Committee. All those in the favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no.
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 The ayes have it, and the motion prevails. House File 4659.
Yeah, sorry, Madam Chair. I believe the motion was to send it to Judiciary, and you had said Climate.
My apologies. I will redo the motion. Renewing my motion wrong motion. Renew my motion for the House File 3410 as amended. Be referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say no.
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 The ayes have it and the motion prevails. House File 3410 as amended is we refer to the Judiciary Committee. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Our next bill is House File 4655. And I will switch gavel with Vice Chair. Representative Vang, when you are ready, do you wish to move your bill? Yes, so move. I move for it to House File 4655 to be laid over for consideration. And I also have the DE1 amendment to Madam Chair.
Would you like to move the DE1 amendment, Representative Vang?
Yes. If I will ask member support for the DE, it would just put in the shape that I would like it to be.
All those in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author would like, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The ayes have it. And to your bill, Representative Vang, as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So with the DE, it narrows the scope to just waterfowl eggs. So this includes such as ducks, geese, and swans. These eggs takes longer to hatch and require more needs to take care of. Of course, this is the first time we've heard any bill like this in the Ag Committee, as far as I know. And I've heard loud and clear from the Ag community and in education how much they value this part of agriculture education. So in an effort to still raise awareness about proper care about our animals and also address their concerns, the DE narrows the scope, which affects a smaller percentage of these types of school projects. The meat of the bill, really, or why we're doing this bill, is schools get fertilized eggs and classroom incubators wanting to see the miracle of life or where food comes from. While what can be a cute and educational project, it can be a serious health risk to the animals, children, adults, wildlife, and livestock. The best incubator is a real mama bird. The embryo signals its needs to her, and the mama responds with necessary adjustments for her eggs. In artificial incubation, proper temperatures, humidity, ventilation, position, and frequent rotation of the waterfowl eggs are not always done correctly and are difficult to maintain. So fluctuations cause birds to hatch sickly, dehydrated, and/or deformed, such as organs growing outside of the body or being stuck in the shell. Most schools do not provide necessary veterinary care for the many birds born ill and deformed. Hatchings can happen in the evening or on the weekend, and when there isn't someone there to feed nor help them. There are also health risks to children and teachers from the eggs and birds. Salmonella infection is a factor which children are much more susceptible to. Not all of the birds find suitable homes as well. People often release birds, especially ducks, in the parks, not realizing the birds do not have the same natural instincts to protect themselves, the biosecurity risk to wildlife and livestock, and that it's illegal. Most farms do not accept taking birds hatch elsewhere due to the biosecurity risks, and if they do, they kill birds to prevent the potential disease transmission to their flocks. Children thrive when connecting with nature and animals, especially in these early stages of development. However, observing eggs in an incubator is not the natural world. We have vast options where animals' proper care are met and biosecurity is not put in jeopardy. There are plenty of alternatives to hatching waterfowl eggs that inspire students to appreciate and learn about the amazing life of birds, nature walks, sanctuary visits, live camera feeds, and life cycle models are only a few examples. And with that, Madam Chair, I have a few testifiers too as well.
Thank you very much. We will move to testimony. And the first person I have on my list is Dr. Jamie Nalesny.
Good job.
Thank you. Please approach the stand, identify yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. All right, I'm sorry, you just switched on me and I got very confused. I'm Jamie Nalesny. I'm a veterinarian in Minnesota. I have a statement I'd just like to read. Thank you for hearing this bill today. I've been an avian vet in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Texas for about 19 years. I'm here in support of the school egg hatching bill for the sake of animal and human health, biosecurity, and wildlife conservation. My career, focused on avian and exotic animals, has exposed me to numerous cases where poor incubation practices led to deformities, injuries, and diseases in birds, many of which were preventable. I've dealt with outbreaks of diseases like duck viral hepatitis requiring drastic measures, such as euthanizing affected nurseries. Common issues in hatched birds include musculoskeletal injuries, chronic infections, and diseases that are transmissible to wild populations. Pardon me. Many of these which are preventable. These all pose risks to ecosystems and to human health. Diseases like avian influenza and highly pathogenic avian influenza, which it seems that continues to be a conversation here, they underline the need for better biosecurity, and we can do better. You know, other biosecurity concerns that no one has really mentioned are these escaped birds. They can introduce respiratory infections, coccidia, mycoplasma, chlamydia, giardia, cryptosporidia, mycobacterium, that's tuberculosis, et cetera, to flocks. In fact, just today, walking from the parking lot to here, there was a captive released vector right there, just waiting to spread some disease. Or not. I'll be catching this bird up and quarantining, so don't you worry about that one bird. But it's just so unfortunate to see these animals end up escaped or released. I advocate for discontinuing school hatching products and hatching projects and products involving all waterfowl. I feel that these projects can actually negatively impact our children, our teachers, and our veterinarians, emotionally, obviously. But it can also really pose a public health concern with the risks from zoonotic disease. So again, given the recent HPAI outbreaks, and knowing that we just had HPAI down the river, and that was in West Virginia 3 weeks ago, it'll be coming up with the Super Bowl of my life, which is birding and spring migration. So we really should be thinking about this right now. Alternative educational tools, such as Chair Vang has already discussed, such as using a brooder hen, like an actual real life bird. How cool would that be for kids to actually watch? We could do candling exercises with real eggs from the National Poultry Improvement Plan, NPIP is what I usually call it, certified facilities, and they can offer much safer and more enriching experiences. Obviously, I felt very ethically obliged to my veterinary oath to protect human and animal health, to voice my support for this school hatching bill, emphasizing the importance of preventing disease as well as animal welfare. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this important topic, and I hope you will consider moving this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The next testifier I have on my list is Tom Apple. If you are able to approach the stand, please. Please state your name pronounced correctly and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Tom Apple, APPEL. We get that right. I currently serve as the executive director of the Minnesota Association of Agriculture Educators. Our group is comprised of 331 high school agriculture education instructors representing about 226 school districts in the state of Minnesota. When this bill first came to our attention last week, I thought it was imperative that we go ahead and try to come up with assessing what type of impact the original bill, and I'll comment on the amendment shortly, the original bill would have on our students. So I did send a very short email question to our listserv of agricultural educators. It was a simple, do you or anyone in your school district have hatch or have incubated eggs as part of a lesson plan within the poultry industry? I was a bit amazed at the response. As of last night, I had 217 responses. I mentioned that because that's a tremendous number of responses. We have 210 of those 217 that do hatch eggs as part of an educational project, either in elementary school, junior high, high school, could be in a science class, could be in an agriculture class. throughout all of the school district. To me, 97% is a very telling number. So when we first saw that we were going to ban this completely, that became a major issue for our association and for our membership. The amendment itself that was offered to only limit this to waterfowl, as an association, we are going to go neutral on that because we believe that you still can hatch eggs and you can, or excuse me, chicken eggs and other eggs that can accomplish our purposes in these particular lessons. Our biggest reason for wanting to maintain this is the fact that one of the purposes of agriculture education is to teach people in and about agriculture. We in our profession term that agricultural literacy. I believe one of the other testifiers today will talk a little bit about the Minnesota Ag in the Classroom and how vital that is to agriculture education and to letting know people where their food comes from. So I'm going to kind of skip some of that sort of thing there. Received a lot of concerns within the poultry industry, received a lot of concerns from our instructors in terms of this becomes a complete ban. That would not be a good thing for us. Previous testifiers have given a lot of good information. I guess I would like to see some of that information researched further. I am not an expert in as a veterinarian, obviously, but in visiting with a number of my colleagues, visiting with a number of folks from the Board of Animal Health, I think there may be some discussion that needs to take place in terms of is that really effective? Does it really affect avian flu and a number of those other things? So I think there's some more questions that perhaps need to come forward. What I can tell you, as an agriculture instructor for 35 years, we released a lot of birds, day old birds, within my classes. The concept that we're just releasing the birds out into Never Never Land, so to speak, I don't believe that to be true. When we did that, we would go ahead and provide instruction to our students. We would go ahead and visit the site where those chickens were going to be raised or those birds were going to be raised. We would go ahead and provide care guidelines. We would make a pre-visit to that site. We would make a post-visit within 48 hours. So I think the folks that are doing these projects within our education system are extremely responsible, and I think they go ahead and follow up in a very affirmative way to make sure things are being done right. You did receive some letters of opposition to this in your packet, also committee members, so we appreciate that. In closing, I would be very concerned if we start taking away practical, hands-on educational activities that are currently being conducted in 97% of Minnesota schools.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there other testifiers who are interested to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I will move to member questions. Oh, are you interested in testifying for or against the bill?
Yeah.
Okay, please approach the stand, identify yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for allowing me to share my concerns with House File number 4655. I'm Riley Joyer from the Litchfield FFA chapter, and I'm in opposition to the bird hatching ban in schools. There are many agricultural programs in Minnesota schools, as I'm hearing 97%, that is a large number, incubating chickens, turkeys, and ducks in their classrooms. These are in high schools, middle schools, elementary schools, and ag in the classroom programs. I personally know two schools that incubate ducks, and this waterfowl amendment would force them to change their agricultural lesson programs. Incubating poultry in classrooms is important to agricultural education everywhere, as these kids are learning where their food comes from and responsibility by taking care of these animals. Specifically in communities nearby Litchfield, I know the chickens, turkeys, and ducks being raised are very well taken care of, since they are these kids' 4-H and FFA projects that they have brought from their homes to their school and will bring back home to their own farms after this classroom use. On terms of proper care, these students spend lots of class time prior to this project studying poultry and making sure they will take care of these birds properly. As I said before, these 4-H and FFAers specifically are bringing their eggs to school and bringing them home afterwards so that these birds are well taken care of. Thank you for the opportunity to testify against this act, and I encourage you all to vote against it in the best interests of agricultural education of students.
Thank you for your testimony. Other testifiers in the audience who wish to speak on the record? Seeing none, now we will move to member questions. Jacob. Representative Jacob. Sorry, I see a number of hands.
Thank you, Chair Purcell. So, a couple questions. Talk about school. How will this affect FFA 4-H and county fairs?
Representative Bang?
Madam Chair, Representative Jacob, I think it's a pretty straightforward bill to simply ban schools from hatching or incubating waterfowl eggs. So it doesn't ban them to hatch chicken eggs, and so if they need to change their lesson, if they're hatching ducks, they can choose to hatch other types of eggs that are not waterfowls.
Representative Jacob.
I don't think that answered my question. So the extension programs sponsored by the state of Minnesota are where the 4-H and county fair programs come from. So what does this do to those programs?
Representative Vang.
Madam Chair, Representative Jacob, like I said, this only deals with the schools. I don't see ag extension or county fairs being listed as this. And so and perhaps Mr. Sullivan can help take a look at the amendment, but I'm just reading the language here. Is that school board must prohibit a bird hatching project as part of the lesson in a study in a classroom or program. So if that community education is located in a school, then I think that would apply.
Mr. Sullivan, do you care to weigh in on the interpretation of the bill as amended?
Madam Chair and members, I generally agree with the interpretation that Chair Vang just had there, and that's that if the activities Representative Jacob is asking about are considered co-curricular activities or extracurricular activities, which are defined in the bill summary by a colleague of mine who's more familiar with this terminology in the education area, if indeed, for example, 4-H was considered a school-sponsored co-curricular or extracurricular activity, then it would apply, the ban would apply to 4-H held at a school, is my understanding.
Representative Jacob.
Okay. Something that is a priority to me is bringing the rural community and the urban community together, and especially for the urban community to see how the rural community functions. And I feel like this is something that potentially really drives a wedge in that. In the same way that I came to the program we had this summer where we had the greenhouse gardens in the metro area, I didn't see the benefit in that until I went there. And I agree now that's very important for the urban population to see those greenhouses, what's being done there. I think you're taking, just a comment, I think you're taking a very important educational piece away from the community that's bringing urban and rural areas together. So I would feel bad that it's being proposed.
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Purcell. I wasn't sure if this was addressed in any of the comments, but do we know how often birds that are hatched in schools, how often that we run into problems with them? Do we have any data on that?
Representative Vang.
Madam Chair, Representative Harder, I'm not sure if there's any specific infrastructure set up to kind of take a look at how widespread this is, but what I do know is I do know people who do rescues chickens and ducks from these types of projects. Perhaps we can, if the department is here, if they have any data that keeps track of a record of the schools, that do these projects, but I doubt there is. That could be something that we can look at.
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Purcell. The reason why I was asking is because when this bill came out, I was completely surprised of the nature of the bill. And, of course, then I received phone calls from constituents who do work in the classroom, shocked that this is, in their minds, has suddenly become a problem when this has been done in schools for years. And so a constituent of mine did submit some testimony in your folders with pictures, because he does do work in the classrooms, and asked me just to say a few comments about the importance of the hatching within the classrooms. And he basically said that the classroom hatching programs can be integrated into lessons about agriculture, introducing students to fundamental concepts such as breeding, reproduction, and genetic diversity. And the knowledge is foundational for understanding how these processes work, and oftentimes it might lead towards careers. And I know of a number of students that do these projects that lead to 4-H projects. It's just a value for agriculture, another lesson plan, if you want to call it, for students to learn and grow, and to just to know of their surroundings, whether you're dealing with animals, birds, or humans. We need to protect all of life, I would guess I would have to say. But the other thing about this is that the one thought that came to mind, of course, is local control. And school boards are elected. And sometimes I wonder if there is an issue that maybe school boards should be taking this up, along with their parents and teachers, to address if there is a situation in the school that needs to be addressed. That's my only comment. Thank you.
Thank you. We do have three other people on the list, so I'm just going to encourage members to be brief. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to share an anecdote that is quite old, but, you know, I actually used to show ducks in 4-H a long time ago, and I would order those ducks because you go through 4-H and an FFA, you'd order them. You wouldn't hatch them at the school because you were concerned about issues with safety even then. So that's how you got them. You went and ordered from the hatchery, and you got the ducks, and you wanted to have the ducks that were different breeds, and some were market ducks, some were purebred ducks, and you would take care of them and then bring them to the county fair, and you'd bring them to the state fair if you were lucky enough. So it wasn't any hatching at the school. I think when you look at the subdivision 25, I could see where maybe there was a misunderstanding, but the plain language hatching means, I believe, coming from out of an egg. If you were talking about building a wood duck house and you're educating about hatching, that's not hatching an egg. You're doing an educational program. Maybe that just needs to be clarified a little bit. If you're building a wood duck house, that's hatching, but you're not hatching the wood duck in the school. You're talking about it as part of I think the program is like outdoor education or something like that. So I don't think this thing is that, you know, when we look at how it actually works. Now, maybe it's changed in 50 years, but I don't think it has. You still have to order the poultry from a certified hatchery, and usually you get them when they're little and fluffy, not as eggs. So.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Chair Purcell. I know we're running out of time here, so I won't go too long. But thank you, Chair Vang, in your introduction. I think you kind of nailed it to some degree, even though I don't agree with everything about the bill. But you mentioned the miracle of life, and in particular, that resonated with me, especially given the emotional testimony from a veterinarian first up. You mentioned how the embryo signals its needs to the mother. I think it's an interesting concept, and I think that's what kids, you know, the idea that we're teaching our kids how life works and the life cycle of the egg. And just beyond that, I think I'll tie this into, you know, the fact that we're seeing such a vet shortage. I just think the hands-on learning that this kind of a program provides our kids in school and the fact that you're trying to entice kids to look at that as a career option, which is really important. So I'd hope that this doesn't go any farther down the road, because I think it's really important if we're going to inspire our kids to be in agriculture and especially a veterinarian. So thanks for that.
Thank you, Representative Burkle. Representative Chong.
Yes, I just want some clarification. I don't know who can answer this, but is the 4-H and FFA program part of the educational curriculum at a school? Do we have a definite answer on that, or do we know?
This is the question to Mr. Sullivan or to Representative Vang?
Well, Madam Chair, I believe our testifier, Mr. Apple, can come help answer this question.
Please restate your name for the record and answer briefly, please.
Tom Apple, Executive Director of MAAE. I believe I can provide some clarification for that. It's how I would interpret it with being in agriculture education for 44 years. The 4-H piece, I don't believe you're going to see eggs from 4-H being hatched in a school. I mean, as Representative Vang had said, this bill is specifically to have an incubator on school property. I believe that is the purpose of this. I believe that's for clarity. Referring to the FFA portion of it, I don't believe it would be any effect on county fairs. If an individual person went ahead and did that incubation on there, yes, some eggs are purchased for incubating. Majorities are actually individual day-old birds that are purchased. I don't believe there will be any impact with this bill on the FFA and the 4-H. I know when you look at co-curricular, and we can have a great debate here over the FFA, if that's co-curricular or extracurricular, it actually in statute, in federal statute, is intracurricular. It's an extension of the agriculture education classroom. So it technically doesn't fit in statute under either of those clauses.
Thank you, Mr. Apple. Representative Chaw, follow up.
Yes, I was just keep it short. Thank you for the clarification, because I do think the FFA programs and FHA programs are vital to the future farmers of America. So thank you for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Lead Anderson is our final member on the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I think that does need to be clarified. Good point, Representative Chaw. And I would think too that 4-H is outside of a school situation. I want to say thanks to Chair Vang for the amendment. The bill, when it was got its number last Thursday, really created quite a stir around the state, at least, maybe further. So thank you for the amendment. But I just would add a comment that when the veterinarian testified and she talked about the long list of possible, you know, problems, diseases, whatever, that could be introduced by the hatching of these little babies. The question becomes, why then allow chicks to be hatched? I mean, if the danger is whatever degree, biosecurity risks are quite high from the hatching of ducks and geese, for example, do those same things apply to chicks? And I hope it doesn't. So, again, I thank you for the amendment, but if there's a danger in one area, there maybe is a danger in others as well.
Representative Anderson, is that rhetorical, or are you looking for a particular response from the veterinarian who testified?
If you have time, yeah, she could clarify that, yeah.
Please approach the stand again and reintroduce yourself for the record and answer as briefly as you are able to and address the question from Lead Anderson.
I'm Dr. Jamie Nalesny, and I thank you for the question. As far as the ducks versus the chickens go, the disease transmission. The biggest reason for ducks to transmit disease versus chickens, we are very careful with our chickens all in, all out, not having to depopulate. But the ducks fly, and they get away. And they're bigger, and they're messier, and they're more expensive. So people surrender them, or they often get released. So when they get released and they decide to mingle with the other ducks that came up with avian influenza, or they're introducing a potential disease into the classroom. So that's where everybody is affected, is the kids, when it comes down to infectious disease. But that's just with the hatching. I'm discussing when these birds get out of the classroom. That's what worries me for disease transmission, because I see the duck. I have ducks that fly to my house that are domestic. There's a domestic fowl outside that is not a chicken that could be just spreading disease. So is that an okay answer for you to clarify that?
Lead Anderson. Closing remarks, Representative Bang.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for your discussion. And this bill will be laid over, and if there are still ongoing concerns, I'm happy to continue on that conversation too as well. And with that, Madam Chair, if you can lay over House File 4655 as amended.
House File 4655 as amended is laid over.
All right, members, we only have two bills left. I think it'll be short, so if you guys can keep this brief to us. Well, there are agency bills, and so we have a first one, House File 3821, Representative Sensimera. This is regarding the Food Safety Defense Task Force provision. And I will move that this bill be laid over for possible inclusion. And so to the bill, Representative Sensimera.
Yeah, thank you. So this bill would extend the expiration date for the Food Safety and Defense Task Force by 10 years. It's supposed to expire in June of 2027. This would move it to June of 2037. This task force advises the legislature and MDA regarding food and safety issues. They were very helpful during the pandemic, specifically looking at certain supply chain issues. It includes the commissioners of agriculture and health, as well as representatives of certain federal agencies, the Minnesota Grocery Association, statewide farm organizations, food and health professionals, and the University of Minnesota. MDA is available if there's any more questions about the bill.
All right, I see no testifiers, so questions to the bill. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Quickly, usually we don't extend some of these things until a year or two before they're due to expire. Why 3 years ahead of time?
Yeah.
Representative.
Someone from MDA want to come down and...
Do we have commissioner or... Oh, I see a staff member. If you can identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. I'm Kim Carlton. I'm the manager of the Retail Food Safety Program at Department of Agriculture. The reason for the extension is to align it with the governor's four-year appointments to the task force. There are 10 members who are appointed, and this is a cleanup on our renewal of our membership.
Representative Anderson. Further discussion? Seeing none, House File 3821 is laid over. Our next bill is House File 4699, Representative Purcell. This is also another agency bill, and so we'll consider House File 4699 to be laid over for possible inclusion to the bill. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bill that comes to us from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. MDA seeks statutory changes to be in compliance with federal regulation. Every state in the nation will be making similar statutory changes to their plan and regulations to get into compliance with revised federal regulations. If these changes become part of Statute 18B, MDA will work with both the public and private pesticide license holders and the University of Minnesota for the next 3 to 4 years to bring applicators into compliance. There are two proposed legislative changes that might impact the applicators. One is a minimum age of 18 for all applicators, and two, definition of use. Currently, there are not many licensed applicators who are below 18 years old, so this would not impact very many folks. Plus, in the 3 to 4 years, those folks might turn 18 in that time. And then the new requirement of having a license for mixer, loader, handler type duties would impact the applicators. In this proposal, MDA has focused the definition of use specifically for the mixer, loader, handler individuals only who use restricted use pesticides. So this means those individuals that perform these duties with general use pesticides would not need to be licensed. Because of this distinction, MDA believes that these changes would not impact the industry significantly. And in the past, MDA has always worked with the pesticide industry to work collaboratively to bring them into compliance of any new regulations, and the agency has agreed to do that as such.
All right, I see no testifiers, so questions to the bill. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I have a question about one word in the bill, and that has to do with those that handle chemicals. A lot of times the co-ops in the spring have trouble finding people to work, and they may hire retired guys or whomever to haul water out to a sprayer, for example. And they may also, in the course of hauling water out, bring out a box of chemicals. So in this case, if the driver picked up that box of chemicals, set it up on top of a trailer, does that mean he's handling chemicals and needs to have a license?
I believe I see a staff member. If you can identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Gurinder Chahal, Supervisor, Licensing and Certification Unit at the Department of Ag. Thank you, Representative Anderson, for your question. So this is a new territory we are exploring for the mixer handlers and the loaders. To answer your question specifically, if the container is sealed, they don't need to be licensed, and that container must be a restricted-use pesticide. Also, I would like to add, there may be more questions related to that. As Representative Purcell, she mentioned that we will be working very closely with the pesticide industry, as traditionally we did. So we will go by case-by-case basis, so see how who needs license for mixer, loader, and handlers. So, but if you have any further questions, please let me know.
Representative Anderson. Further discussion. Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Vang. So many times when we put more restrictions on restricted use chemicals, the nature is to try to get by without those restricted use chemicals. So do you have any data on what you think the carbon footprint would be that would be you'd be increasing by having farmers potentially use more passes of non-restricted chemicals in order to supplant the chemicals that they might not use because now they aren't able to move them?
Director?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative, for your question. I can speak from my professional background. I'm a weed scientist trained for more than 15 years, so it depends on the pest. So if the pest, and you can imagine that we are living in the corn and soybean country, how we have weeds are getting resistance to different chemistries out there. So if that weed is not controlled by the general use pesticide, then you have to apply restricted use pesticide. I don't know from where we can get the data that if we put more restrictions on the restricted use pesticides. I don't think these amendments are adding any restrictions to the restricted use pesticides and moving people toward the general use pesticides. And so I don't think there would be any increase in the carbon footprint. Let me know if I didn't answer your question completely.
Representative Jacob.
I'm just going off of experience as a farmer, and many times I will, if it's a restricted use and I don't have the proper licensing and I can get by with non-restricted, I do that. So.
So thanks for your comment. Just to further elaborate on that, because we are not putting additional restrictions. This is the new license type. We are adding mixer, loader, and handlers. There's no additional restrictions on the applicators. So we are not moving people from general use pesticide toward the restricted use. It is the other way around.
Further discussion. Closing remarks, Representative Purcell?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Vang. To that comment, too, so all 50 states are needing to make a change, and we need to do this within our Department of Agriculture, or this will be done for us by the federal government. So we are trying to make the transition as smooth as possible. The department has been telling folks when they're getting their research since 2017 that this is coming. They'll continue to work with folks for the next 3 to 4 years to be up to compliance. So I appreciate your support of the bill. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Hearing no further discussion, the bill is laid over. Thank you, members, for staying a couple extra minutes late. Our next meeting is Thursday, March 14, 2024. This meeting is adjourned.